was set for Monday night, August 21st, in front of a military audience at Fort Myer in Virginia. This was a big deal, one of Trump's first formal announcements of a policy before a large audience. My original instinct was to pull out, and historically, I like following my instincts, Trump said. Three times he said the goal was to win, and said, "We will not talk about numbers of troops or our plans for further military." With that, Trump dodged Bush's and Obama's Achilles heel. His strategy had the effect of pushing the Afghanistan war debate away, off the front page and out of the news, unless there was a major act of violence. John McCain commented, "I commend President Trump for taking a big step in the right direction with the new strategy for Afghanistan." Democratic Senator and Clinton running mate Tim Kaine said the U.S. needed to make sure that Afghanistan is not a breeding ground for things that can come back and hurt us. Bannon spoke with Stephen Miller. "What the fuck was that speech about?" Bannon said. "First of all, it just went around in circles." The speech did not really go in circles. It was both new and more of the same Obama strategy. Bannon's chief objection was the lack of realism. "You can't have him sitting there talking about victory. There's not going to be a victory." Trump clung to the rhetoric of winning. He had given the military, Mattis and McMaster, just enough. The military had saved face and did not have to admit defeat. The day after the president's speech, Tillerson found another way to declare that a win was not attainable. He addressed the Taliban at a press briefing. "You will not win a battlefield victory. We may not win one, but neither will you." Stalemate. Chapter 32. Kelly and Porter spent several weeks at Bedminster with the president during the August congressional recess. The new chief of staff was of the view that the White House was a muddle. Priebus and Bannon had been amateurs. He would instill some order and discipline. "We sort of tried to do this a little bit," Porter said. He told Kelly how Priebus had taken a run at establishing order. Several months earlier, Priebus had the top staffers, McMaster, Cohn, Bannon, Kellyanne Conway, and Porter, for a meeting in a strategy room in the executive office building. "We need a strategy," Priebus had said. "What are the priorities? How are we going to sequence them?" He wrote the ideas on whiteboards that lined the walls of the strategy room. It was like a skiff for the most highly classified discussions. It was filled with computers and video teleconferencing equipment. Ideas from the session were never taken seriously. The president often made decisions with only one or two or three people involved. There was no process for making and coordinating decisions. Chaos and disorder were inadequate to describe the situation. It was a free-for-all. The president would have an idea and say, "I want to sign something." And Porter would have to explain that while Trump had broad authority to issue executive orders, for example, a president was frequently restricted by law. Trump had no understanding of how government functioned. At times, he would just start drafting orders himself or dictating. The basic tactic Porter had employed from the previous days until now was to stall and delay, mention the legal roadblocks, and occasionally lift the drafts from the Resolute desk. Porter had been screaming bloody process, as he called it, every day for months. They needed an iron grip on what was signed and ordered. If not iron, they needed at least something, a thread of control. On August 21st, Kelly and Porter issued two memorandums to all cabinet officers and senior White House assistants. "The White House Staff Secretary, Porter, serves as both the inbox and outbox for all presidential materials. Every single piece of paper, including decision memos, every memo, press releases, even news articles, had to go through Porter. Executive orders would take at least 2 weeks to complete, including required review by the White House Counsel and the Justice Department Office of Legal Counsel, which provided legal interpretation to the White House. All paper leaving the Oval Office must be submitted to the Staff Secretary for compliance with the Presidential Records Act. A second memo, underlined in the original, said, "Decisions are not final and therefore may not be implemented until the Staff Secretary secures a cleared decision memoranda that has been signed by the President." This included all new policy initiatives such as budget, healthcare, trade initiatives, and government operations such as diplomatic, intelligence, or military operations. A decision made following an oral briefing is not final until there was a formal decision memo. It was a fantasy. Kelly and Porter sat down with the President to explain the revamped process. "You can't make decisions unless you sign a decision memo," Porter said. The memo did not have to be long. "I'll keep it to a page." Porter noted that decision memos would have supporting materials, "but I won't ever make you read more than a page on any decision. I'll come in and I'll brief you on it as well, so we can talk through it. Sometimes you'll need to have a full meeting with 5 or 6 or 7 advisors. A lot of times we can just do it on the basis of a decision memo." "Okay," Trump said. For the first weeks, the new system annoyed the President. Eventually, Porter developed a routine and would bring in 2 to 10 decision memos for him to sign each day. Trump liked signing. It meant he was doing things, and he had an up-and-down penmanship that looked authoritative in black magic marker. Kelly was very chummy with the President in the first weeks, Porter noticed. They were peers. Kelly always seemed to have a smile on his face when he was around the President. He would joke around with Trump. He would give advice and offer his reaction. "Mr. President, I think we ought to do this." He was deferential. "I'm just a staffer. You're the boss. We want to try to get you the best information." The perfect chief of staff. "You're the decider, and I'm not trying to sway you one way or the other." The honeymoon was soon over. Beginning in September, Kelly and Porter would be together alone or with a few senior staffers. "The President's unhinged," Kelly said. There would be something, especially about trade agreements or the U.S. troops in South Korea. "We all need to try to talk him out of it," Kelly said. They needed to stand up to the President. He wasn't listening. Oval Office business and decision-making became increasingly haphazard. "The President just really doesn't understand anything about that. He doesn't know what he's talking about," Kelly said. As Trump redoubled on withdrawing from trade agreements or costly foreign policies, Kelly would say, "I can't believe he's thinking about doing this." He made a personal appeal to Porter. "Rob, you've got to put a stop to this. Don't write that order up. Don't go down and do that. Can you go in and talk to him and just see if you can make any progress? I was on the phone with him this morning. I made these arguments. Can you go see what good you can do?" The U.S. troop presence in South Korea continued to be a constant theme with Trump. "We are subsidizing South Korea," he insisted. "It doesn't make any sense." Porter reminded him that Mattis and many others had told him these were possibly the best national security dollars that the United States spent. The troop presence provided the indispensable top-secret intelligence that was vital to detecting and deterring North Korean missile launches. On August 25th, the President decided he was going to make a sweeping decision on NAFTA, CORUS, and the World Trade Organization. "We've talked about this ad nauseum," Trump said. "Just do it. Just do it. Get out of NAFTA, get out of CORUS, and get out of the WTO. We're withdrawing from all three." Cohn and Porter enlisted Kelly, who didn't want trade to royal national security. Kelly and Porter went to the Oval Office. "South Korea is an ally," Kelly told Trump. "The CORUS deal is actually better than you think." Porter presented some studies showing that CORUS kept the trade deficit down. "This is a really important time with North Korea and that whole region," Kelly said. "We don't want to do anything on the trade side, especially given how peanuts this is in the grand scheme of things. It's going to blow things up." He recommended that the President call Tillerson. Tillerson made the same arguments. Tillerson, Mattis, McMaster, Kelly, everyone on the national security side agreed that if the trade deficit with South Korea had been 10 times greater, it still wouldn't justify withdrawing. It was insane to even be thinking of that, they agreed. All right, Trump finally said on Friday, September 1st, we're not going to do the chorus 180-day thing today. It's not that we're not going to do it, but all right, we won't do it today. Porter put out the word to the legislative staff, the White House lawyers, and the NSC staff to rest easy for at least that day. He made sure there was nothing drafted that the president could sign. 4 days later, on September 5th, Cohn, Porter, and the others went to the Oval Office. Trump had in his hands a draft letter giving notice of the required 180 days that the United States was withdrawing from CORUS. Porter had not written it, and he was never sure who had, probably Navarro or Ross, but he never found out for sure. I've got a draft, Trump said. We're going to withdraw from this. I just need to wordsmith this, and we're going to get it on official stationery and send this off. We need to do it today. McMaster made the national security arguments. Cohn and Porter made the trade and economic arguments. Until I actually take some action to demonstrate my threats are real and need to be taken seriously, Trump said, then we're going to have less leverage in these things. He then left the Oval Office. Now that the president had gone outside of the staff secretary process that Porter controlled to get a new draft letter, Cohn was really worried. He removed it from the president's desk. For the first several months of his job as chief of staff, it seemed that Kelly sat in the Oval Office almost every day in every meeting. He didn't say much, acting more as an observer and monitor. He tried to make sure that the door was closed between the Oval Office and the little outer office where Madeleine Westerhout sat. She was 27, a former RNC aide, and looked like Hope Hicks with her long brown hair and big smile. The stated reason was to provide more privacy and security. Kelly also wanted to keep people from wandering in and out as they had done regularly in the past. No, no, leave it open, the president would say. I need to be able to see Madeleine so that I can call out to her. Rear Admiral Ronnie Jackson, the president's White House physician, stopped by to see the president most days, certainly several times a week. How are you doing today, Mr. President? He would say, sticking his head out of his office as the president passed by. It would usually be a 30-second check-in, often about something like a nasal spray. Several times, Dr. Jackson visited Kelly. The president's been under a lot of stress recently, Jackson said at one point. We may need to figure out some way to dial things back or to ease up on his schedule. Another time, Jackson was more specific. Seems like the president's under more stress than usual. We may just want to try to cut back on the schedule tomorrow. Kelly's solution was to give the president more executive time. Trump normally set his own schedule on when to start the day and often had flexibility when he returned to the residence. Kelly tried to respond to Jackson. Which meetings were essential? Could they give Trump an extra half hour or an hour in the mornings or clear his schedule an hour earlier in the evenings? They tried. But the nonstop presidency did not abate, and Trump often got everyone, himself included, spun up. Trump assembled a group in the residence to discuss steel tariffs. Ross, Navarro, Lighthizer, Cohn, McMaster, and Porter attended. Trump said he was tired of the debate and wanted to sign a decision memo to implement 25% steel tariffs across the board with no exemptions for any country. They had the usual Groundhog Day round of arguments until Mnuchin said that tax reform had to be the number one priority. A Republican-held House, Senate, and White House was a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity to pass tax reform, he said. It had not been done since Reagan's presidency more than 30 years earlier. Mnuchin warned that many of the Republican senators he would need for tax reform were free traders and strongly opposed steel tariffs. Mr. President, you could lose them, he said. Cohn seconded this, and Porter agreed. McMaster, who had been arguing on national security grounds that steel tariffs would severely damage relations with key allies, agreed about taxes and Republican senators. "Yeah, you're right," Trump finally said. "As important as this is, we can't jeopardize the tax bill for this. So, we'll hold off. But as soon as we're done with taxes, we're going to move to trade. And one of the first things that we need to do is put these steel tariffs on." With Bannon out of the White House, Trump and Sessions came up with another solution for immigration on September 5th. Trump announced the end of the Obama-era DACA program. He labeled it an amnesty-first approach and said Congress should find a replacement in 6 months. 2 days later, he tried to calm everyone down. On September 7th, Trump tweeted, "For all those, DACA, that are concerned about your status during the six-month period, you have nothing to worry about. No action." Bannon, who still had access to Trump, called to remind him of the importance of hardline anti-immigration. "Do you understand this almost destroyed the Republican Party in the summer of 2013? Bannon recalled asking the president. "This is the central reason you're president. The one thing that can destroy the Republican Party. It's been haunting us, this amnesty issue." Stephen Miller passed word from the White House to Bannon that this whole debate was now about chain migration. He calculated that the current policy would add 50 million new immigrants in 20 years if it continued. Miller told Bannon, "The Democrats will never give up on chain migration. It's changed the country. Chain migration is everything. That's how they get the family unification." Miller turned out to be correct. Trump might continue to talk as if he would compromise, but there was no deal with Democrats. "I don't have any good lawyers," Trump said one day in the Oval Office. "I have terrible lawyers." He singled out White House counsel Don McGahn. "I've got a bunch of lawyers who are not aggressive, who are weak, who don't have my best interests in mind, who aren't loyal. It's just a disaster. I can't find a good lawyer." He included the personal lawyers he had handling the Mueller investigation. Porter went to Kelly's office to give him a heads up. It was just the two of them. "I've seen this before," Porter said. "I'm concerned because there have been some times in the past, including especially after the appointment of the special counsel, the Comey-Mueller period, where the president got so consumed and distracted that it was a challenge to continue to do the work and make the decisions, effectively to be president, and to give the direction that the rest of us needed to be able to carry on the work of the government. Thankfully, we got through it. I'm concerned that there are going to be those kinds of flare-ups again, especially as the investigation takes its course, as things come to a head. I don't know what the catalyst is going to be." "It could even be something from the Senate and House Russia investigations. Or who knows what. But we need to be cognizant of this. If we don't do a better job of partitioning things, of giving him time and space to deal with some of the Mueller stuff where the president could get his head in a better place, then it is going to infect the rest of the White House." Trump needed time to vent and sort of emotionally stabilize himself. Porter urged Kelly to give this some thought, so that you can be prepared, so that we can continue to function and this doesn't lead to an incapacitation of the entire West Wing for days, if not weeks, like it kind of did in the past. Kelly nodded. "Yeah, I've seen little bits and pieces of that, and I can imagine it being that bad." "We barely got by the last time it happened," Porter said. "It could be even worse than before. So we need to start to game out a plan for how to handle that." Kelly agreed that made sense. "Let's try," he said. But neither had an immediate idea. Chapter 33. It was not just the distraction of a wide-ranging Mueller investigation hanging over his head, but the constant media coverage that Trump had colluded with the Russians and/or obstructed justice, a real feeding frenzy, vicious, uncivil. The result, Porter said, in some moments it was almost incapacity of the president to be president. McMaster noticed it. Trump normally wouldn't listen long or very carefully to his national security adviser, but it had gotten much worse, McMaster told Porter. It's like I can't even get his attention. Don't take it personally, Porter advised. He's clearly distracted. He's been like that all day because he's focused on this news about Russia. Gary Cohn told Porter, it's pointless to even talk to him today. Hope Hicks was worried. He's worked up about this, she told Porter. She wanted the president to settle down, avoid doing or saying anything rash or that he would later regret. She would try to get Trump to talk about other things, get his attention away from the television, even try to make light of things. They would get him on Air Force One to a rally. Leaving the plane for one rally, he said, I think I'm going to spend the first 10 minutes just attacking the media. On several occasions, Trump asked Porter if he was interested in being White House counsel. Porter declined. When Trump's personal attorney came to talk about matters relating to Special Counsel Mueller, Trump at times asked Porter to join in. Rob, I want you to stay. You've got to be a part of this. I'm not your lawyer, Porter said. I'm not acting as a lawyer, but even if I was, I'd be a government lawyer, not one of your personal lawyers, and that would break attorney-client privilege. And so, I can't be in here. No, Trump said. That doesn't matter. It would take one of Trump's personal lawyers, like John Dowd, saying, Rob needs to go. I don't know how much longer I can stay, Gary Cohn told Porter, because things are just crazy here. They're so chaotic. He's never going to change. It's pointless to prepare a meaningful, substantive briefing for the president that's organized where you have a bunch of slides, because you know he's never going to listen. We're never going to get through it. He's going to get through the first 10 minutes, and then he's going to want to start talking about some other topic. And so we're going to be there for an hour, but we're never going to get through this briefing. Porter tried to prepare organized briefing papers with relevant information, different viewpoints, costs/benefits, pros and cons, and consequences of a decision. It didn't work. Gary Cohn and Robert Lighthizer, the U.S. trade representative, had worked for months to get Trump to agree to authorize an intellectual property inquiry into China's trade practices. It was a case where Trump could flex his anti-trade muscle without blowing up a trade agreement. The authority came from Section 301 of the Trade Act of 1974, which gave the president power to unilaterally institute punitive trade restrictions on countries that engage in unfair trading with the U.S. The Chinese broke every rule. They stole everything, from tech companies' trade secrets to pirated software, film, and music, and counterfeited luxury goods and pharmaceuticals. They bought parts of companies and stole the technology. They stole intellectual property from American companies that had been required to move their technology to China to operate there. Cohn considered the Chinese dirty, rotten scoundrels. The administration estimated China had committed $600 billion in intellectual property theft. A 301 investigation, 301 for short, would give Lighthizer 1 year to determine whether the Office of the U.S. Trade Representative should open a formal investigation of China. If so, Trump would have the authority to impose tariffs, sanctions, and other measures against China. The Europeans, Japanese, and Canadians would join the United States in a massive, coordinated effort against Chinese intellectual property violations. This would be the first trade enforcement by Trump. Trump had finally agreed to sign a memo and announce in a speech a year-long investigation of China's intellectual property violations. It had been a long march to provide him with clear, definable action on the trade front. During an August meeting in the residence with his economic and trade teams, Trump balked. He had just talked to President Xi. He didn't want to target China. We're going to need their help for North Korea, he said. It's not just one UN Security Council vote. We'll need their help on an ongoing basis. I want to take all the references to China out of the speech. He did not want to jeopardize his great relations with President Xi. Porter said the short two-page memo mentioned China five times, and only China. It was all about China, as they had been discussing for months. "No, no, no," Trump said. "I don't want to make it China-specific. Let's just do it for the whole world." Under the law, these investigations have to be about particular unfair trade practices by a specific country. "In this case, it's China," Porter said. "We can't get around the fact." "Well, okay," the president said. "I can sign whatever, but I don't want to mention China in the remarks." "We can't explain what this is without mentioning that we're targeting China." "Okay," Trump said. In his public remarks, he said, "The theft of intellectual property by foreign countries costs our nation millions of jobs and billions of dollars each and every year. For too long, this wealth has been drained from our country while Washington has done nothing. But Washington will turn a blind eye no longer." He made one mention of China. Cohn and Porter hoped signing the memo authorizing a 301 investigation would divert Trump from imposing steel and aluminum tariffs immediately. Whenever either of them would challenge Trump's conviction on the importance of trade deficits and the need to impose tariffs, Trump was immovable. "I know I'm right," he said. "If you disagree with me, you're wrong." Cohn knew the real battle was going to be over tariffs, where Trump had the most rigid views and where he could do the most damage to the U.S. and world economies. He shoveled all the data he could to the president about how tariffs on imported steel would be a disaster and hurt the economy. A 17-page document that Cohn sent contained a chart showing the minuscule revenue earned in 2002 to 2003 when President Bush had imposed steel tariffs for similar reasons. It showed that the revenue that came in was $650 million. That was 0.04% of the total federal revenue of $1.78 trillion. The estimated revenue from a 25% steel tariff would now be $3.4 billion, or 0.09% of expected total revenue of $3.7 trillion for 2018. Tens of thousands of U.S. jobs had been lost in industries that consumed steel, Cohn said, and produced a chart to prove it. Trump had three allies who agreed with him that trade deficits mattered: Secretary of Commerce Wilbur Ross, Peter Navarro, and Bob Lighthizer, the U.S. trade representative. Navarro said that the data did not include the jobs created in the steel mills under the Bush tariffs of 2002 to 2003. "You're right," Cohn said. "We created 6,000 jobs in steel mills." "Your data is just wrong," Navarro said. Trump was determined to impose steel tariffs. "Look," Trump said, "we'll try it. If it doesn't work, we'll undo it." "Mr. President," Cohn said, "that's not what you do with the U.S. economy." Because the stakes were so high, it was crucial to be conservative. "You do something when you're 100% certain it will work, and then you pray like hell that you were right. You don't do 50-50s with the U.S. economy." "If we're not right," Trump repeated, "we roll them back." NAFTA was another enduring Trump target. The president had said for months he wanted to leave NAFTA and renegotiate. "The only way to get a good deal is to blow up the old deal. When I blow it up, in that 6 months, they'll come running back to the table." His theory of negotiation was that to get to yes, you first had to say no. "Once you blow it up," Cohn replied, "it may be over. That's the most high-risk strategy. That either works or you go bankrupt." Cohn realized that Trump had gone bankrupt 6 times and seemed not to mind. Bankruptcy was just another business strategy. Walk away, threaten to blow up the deal. Real power is fear. Over the decades, Goldman Sachs had not done business with the Trump Organization or Trump himself, knowing that he might stiff anyone and everyone. He would just not pay or sue. Early in Cohn's time at Goldman, there had been a junior salesperson who did a bond trade for a casino with Trump. Cohn told the young trader that if the trade didn't settle, he would be fired. Fortunately for the trader, Trump did pay. Applying this mindset from his real estate days to governing and deciding to risk bankrupting the United States would be a different matter entirely. In another discussion with the president, Cohn unveiled a Commerce Department study showing the U.S. absolutely needed to trade with China. If you're the Chinese and you want to really just destroy us, just stop sending us antibiotics. You know, we don't really produce antibiotics in the United States. The study also showed that 9 major antibiotics were not produced in the United States, including penicillin. China sold 96.6% of all antibiotics used here. We don't produce penicillin. Trump looked at Cohn strangely. Sir, so when mother's babies are dying of strep throat, what are you going to say to them? Cohn asked Trump if he would tell them, trade deficits matter? We'll buy it from another country, Trump proposed. So now the Chinese are going to sell it, antibiotics, to the Germans, and the Germans are going to mark it up and sell it to us. So our trade deficit will go down with the Chinese, up with the Germans. U.S. consumers would be paying a markup. Is that good for our economy? Navarro said they would buy it through some country other than Germany. Same problem, Cohn said. You're just rearranging deck chairs on the Titanic. The U.S. automobile industry was another Trump obsession. China was hurting the industry dramatically and U.S. workers even more, he alleged. Cohn assembled the best statistics that could be compiled. Trump would not read, so Cohn brought charts to the Oval Office. The numbers showed that the American auto industry was fine. One big chart showed Detroit's Big Three were producing 3.6 million fewer cars and light trucks since 1994, but the rest of the U.S., mostly in the Southeast, was up the same 3.6 million. The entire BMW 3 Series in the world were made in South Carolina, Cohn said. The Mercedes SUVs were all made in the United States. The millions of auto jobs lost in Detroit had moved to South Carolina and North Carolina because of right-to-work laws. What about the empty factories? Trump asked. We've got to fix this. Cohn had put another document, U.S. Record in WTO Disputes, in the daily book that Porter compiled for the president at night. But Trump rarely, if ever, cracked it open. The World Trade Organization is the worst organization ever created, Trump said. We lose more cases than anything. This is in your book, sir, Cohn said, and brought out another copy. The document showed that the United States won 85.7% of its WTO cases, more than average. The United States has won trade disputes against China on unfair extra duties on U.S. poultry, steel and autos, as well as unfair export restraints on raw materials and rare earth materials. The United States has also used the dispute settlements system to force China to drop subsidies in numerous sectors. This is bullshit, Trump replied. This is wrong. This is not wrong. This is data from the United States Trade Representative. Call Lighthizer and see if he agrees. I'm not calling Lighthizer, Trump said. Well, Cohn said, I'll call Lighthizer. This is the factual data. There's no one that's going to disagree with this data. Then he added, data is data. Cohn occasionally sought Vice President Pence's help, always in private conversations. He made his case on steel and aluminum tariffs. Mike, I need your help on this. You're doing the right thing, Pence said. I'm just not sure what I can do. Mike, there's no state going to be hurt worse than Indiana on steel and aluminum tariffs. Elkhart, Indiana is the boat and RV capital of the world. What goes into boats and RVs? Aluminum and steel. Your state is going to get killed on this. Yeah. I got it. Can you help me? Doing everything I can. As usual, Pence was staying out of the way. He didn't want to be tweeted about or called an idiot. If he were advising Pence, Cohn would have had him do exactly that. Stay out of it. Kelly concluded that Peter Navarro was the problem. Navarro would get into the Oval Office and spin Trump up on the trade deficits. Since he was preaching to the converted, Trump would soon be in full activist mode, declaring, "I will sign today." Cohn took every chance he could get to tell Kelly how Navarro was an absolute disaster. "Get rid of him," Cohn argued. "Fire him. This place is never going to work as long as he is around." Kelly asked Porter for his opinion. "The current status quo is unsustainable," Porter said. "I don't think you can get rid of Peter because the president loves him. He'd never allow for that." "You can't promote Navarro like he wants because that would be absurd." "Peter needs to be responsible to someone other than feeling like he's got a direct report to the president. A lot of times I'm able to block him." Kelly decided he was going to assert control and called a meeting of the combatants for September 26th. It was like a duel. Navarro was allowed to bring in a second, and he chose Stephen Miller. Cohn brought Porter. Navarro started off arguing that during the campaign, he was promised to be an assistant to the president. Now he was only a deputy assistant. "This is a betrayal." He said he couldn't believe it had lasted this long. He had talked to the president, who did not really know the difference between an assistant to the president and a deputy assistant. The president thought special assistant sounded a lot better, not realizing it was an even lower position. Navarro said that the president had told him he could have whatever title and reporting structure he wanted. He and his trade counsel represented the American worker, the manufacturing base, the forgotten man. "Peter's out there going rogue," Cohn responded. "He's creating these problems. He's telling the president lies. He's totally unchecked. He's the source of all the chaos in this building." "Gary doesn't know what he is talking about," Navarro replied. "Gary's just a globalist. He's not loyal to the president." And Porter was always fiddling with the process and manipulating to delay everything so Navarro couldn't get in to see the president. "All right," Kelly said. "I can't deal with this anymore. Peter, you are going to be a member of the National Economic Council, and you're going to report to Gary, and that's just how it's going to be. And if you don't like it, you can quit. Meeting over." "I want to appeal this," Navarro said. "I want to talk to the president." "You are not talking to the president," Kelly said. "Get out of my office." Months went by. "Where the hell is my Peter?" the president asked one day. "I haven't talked to Peter Navarro in 2 months." But as was often the case, he did not follow up. Chapter 34. Trump's face-off with Kim Jong-un was growing increasingly personal. On Air Force One, when tensions were ramping up, Trump said, in a rare moment of reflection, "This guy's crazy. I really hope this doesn't end up going to a bad place." He delivered contradictory comments on North Korea, from provocative and bombastic to assertions that he wanted peace. In May, he said he would be honored to meet with Kim under the right circumstances. In August, he told the press, "North Korea best not make any more threats to the United States. They will be met with fire and fury like the world has never seen." With no resolution, McMaster issued a new strategy outlining a North Korea pressure campaign. The plan, put forward in a signed document, was designed to pressure North Korea and China to negotiate the North's nuclear weapons program and cease development of their ICBMs. Treasury would work on sanctions. State would work on engagement with China to pressure the North. The Defense Department was to make military incursions such as overflights, going into their airspace in exercises called Blue Lightning, and engage in limited cyber activity to demonstrate capability and show the threat. But these actions were not to trigger an unintended conflict. McMaster kept repeating in the NSC that Trump could not accept a nuclear North Korea. But the president summed up his position on almost everything in an interview with the New York Times. "I'm always moving. I'm moving in both directions. Joint Chiefs of Staff Chairman Dunford formed a strategic communications cell in his Operations Directorate, J3, to look at the messaging opportunities in North Korea. What actions could be taken that were just threatening enough to be a deterrent? When there were three aircraft carriers in the vicinity, Mattis voiced discomfort. Could this trigger an unanticipated response from Kim? Could the United States start the war they were trying to avoid? He showed more concern about this than many others in the Pentagon and certainly in the White House. Mattis was a student of historian Barbara Tuchman's book, The Guns of August, about the outbreak of World War I. He's obsessed with August 1914, one official said, and the idea that you take actions, military actions, that are seen as prudent planning, and the unintended consequences are you can't get off the war train. A momentum to war builds, and you just can't stop it. Mattis did not want war. The status quo and a no-war strategy, even amid powerful, overwhelming tensions, were a win-win. The official summed it up. Mattis and Dunford's view is that North Korea can be contained. Dunford actually said, "This was my advice to the president." On September 19, 2017, President Trump gave his first address to the United Nations General Assembly. For the first time, he dubbed the North Korean leader Rocket Man. He said the United States, if forced to defend itself, will have no choice but to totally destroy North Korea. Kim fired back 3 days later. A frightened dog barks louder, and said Trump is surely a rogue and a gangster fond of playing with fire. I will surely and definitely tame the mentally deranged U.S. dotard. In a tweet on September 23rd, Trump called Kim Little Rocket Man. Trump and Rob Porter were together in the president's front cabin on Air Force One. Fox News was on the TV. Little Rocket Man, Trump said proudly. I think that may be my best ever. Best nickname ever. It is funny, Porter said, and it certainly seems to have gotten under Kim's skin. But, he asked, what's the end game here? If we continue to amp up the rhetoric and get into a war of words and it escalates, what are you hoping to get out of this? How does this end? You can never show weakness, Trump replied. You've got to project strength. Kim and others need to be convinced that I'm prepared to do anything to back up our interests. Yes, you want to keep him on his toes, Porter said. And you want some air of unpredictability from you, but he seems pretty unpredictable. And we're not sure, is he even well? Is he all mentally there? He doesn't have the same political constraints that other people do. He seems very much to want to be taken seriously on the international stage. You've got to show strength, the president repeated. I wonder, Porter plowed on, if embarrassing him is more likely to sort of get him into submission, or if it could also provoke him. Trump didn't respond. His body language suggested that he knew Kim was capable of anything. Then he offered his conclusion. It was a contest of wills. This is all about leader versus leader. Man versus man, me versus Kim. At the end of September, General Kelly asked Graham to come to the White House for an upcoming tabletop exercise on North Korea. Contradictory messages from Trump and Tillerson were flooding the news. For weeks, Tillerson had been out publicly with what he called the four no's. The United States was not seeking regime change or a collapse of the regime. Was not looking for an accelerated reunification of the North and South, and did not want an excuse to send troops into the North. We've got the guy guessing, Kelly said to Graham, referring to Kim Jong-un. Graham made a dramatic proposal to Kelly and McMaster. China needs to kill him and replace him with a North Korean general they control, Graham said. China had at least enough control so the North would not attack. I think the Chinese are clearly the key here, and they need to take him out. Not us, them, and control the nuclear inventory there, and wind this thing down, or control him, to stop the march to a big nuclear arsenal. My fear is that he will sell it. He proposed that Trump tell China, "The world is a dangerous place. I am not going to let this regime threaten our homeland with a nuclear weapon." Graham said Trump had told him he would not let this happen. He had done everything but take an ad out in the newspaper telling the world what Trump had told him to his face. On October 1st, months after Tillerson had begun publicly reaching out to North Korea to open a dialogue, Trump tweeted, "I told Rex Tillerson, our wonderful Secretary of State, that he is wasting his time trying to negotiate with Little Rocket Man. Save your energy, Rex. We'll do what has to be done." The bellicose tweet was widely interpreted as undermining the nation's top diplomat. Trump had apparently been seized by an impulse. During the presidential campaign, Trump himself had extended an olive branch, voicing a willingness to negotiate with Kim over a hamburger. But overlooked was that Trump had a way of appearing to strengthen his own hand by creating a situation, often risky, that did not previously exist. Threatening the volatile North Korean regime with nuclear weapons was unthinkable, but he had done it. It turned out to be only the beginning. The go-along, get-along presidency of the past was over. Trump was soon tugging harder on Kelly's leash, and after several months, the Kelly mystique of controlling Trump faded. It was clear that Trump didn't like outsider control emotionally, as if to say, "I can't deal with this anymore. I feel cocooned. I feel I'm no longer in charge." In November, Trump saw Chris Crane, the head of the Immigration and Customs Enforcement, ICE, union, complaining on Fox News about access to Trump. He said Trump was letting them down. The union had endorsed Trump 6 weeks before the election, the first time the National ICE Council, as it was called, had endorsed a presidential candidate. Trump went through the roof. Kelly and Chris Crane had an intense dislike for each other. When Kelly had been Secretary of Homeland Security, he had blocked ICE agents from a hardline crackdown on some immigration violations. Trump invited Crane to the Oval Office without informing Kelly. "Kelly's cut off all our access," Crane said. "We put ourselves on the line for you. We endorsed you. We support all your policies. Now we can't even communicate with you." Kelly heard Crane was in the Oval Office and strode in. Soon, Crane and Kelly were cursing each other. "I can't believe you'd let some fucking guy like this into the Oval Office," Kelly told Trump. "If this was the way it was going to work," he said, "then I quit." And he stormed out. Trump later told others that he thought Kelly and Crane were going to get into a fistfight. Kelly urged the president to select Kirstjen Nielsen, a 45-year-old lawyer who had been Kelly's Department of Homeland Security deputy, as the new secretary. "Kirstjen is the only person who can do this," Kelly argued to the president. "She knows DHS. She was my chief of staff. She's terrific at all this stuff." The nomination was sent to the Senate on October 11th. The president saw that Fox News commentator Ann Coulter called Nielsen an open borders zealot who opposed Trump's border wall. Lou Dobbs piled on, saying Nielsen was pro-amnesty, not a true believer, not an immigration hardliner, and served in the George W. Bush administration. At her confirmation hearing, she had said, "There is no need for a wall from sea to shining sea," and Dobbs, a strong Trump supporter, called this comment outrageous. "Everybody's saying that she's terrible," Trump said later to Kelly in the Oval Office. "It's a joke. She's a bushy. Everybody hates her. How could you have possibly made me do this?" "She's the best," Kelly said. "She's the best of the best. I can personally vouch for her. She's the first woman to lead the department. I know she's a good person. She's doing a great job. She will be very effective. She is on your team. She was my right-hand person when I was there. She knows the department." "That's all bullshit," Trump said. "She's terrible. You're the only one that thinks she's any good. Maybe we'll have to withdraw her nomination. Kelly threw up his hands. Maybe I'm just going to have to resign. And he stormed out. Porter later took Nielsen's commission for Trump to sign that would officially make her secretary. I don't know if I really want to sign this right now, Trump said. I'm just not sure about her. She's been confirmed, Porter said. The Senate had approved her nomination 62-37. You're going to attend her swearing in. Trump signed. Kelly appeared on Fox News' Bret Baier show and said that Trump had gone through an evolutionary process and changed his attitude toward the DACA issue and even the wall. At the White House, Trump went through the roof. Did you see what Kelly said? He asked Porter. I evolved? I've changed on this? Who the fuck does he think he is? I haven't changed one bit. I am exactly where I was. We're going to build the wall. We're going to build it across the entire border. Zach Fuentes, Kelly's assistant, warned the senior staff in the West Wing that Kelly had a short attention span and was easily distracted. He's not a detail guy, said Fuentes, who had also been Kelly's assistant at Homeland Security. Never put more than one page in front of him. Even if he'll glance at it, he's not going to read the whole thing. Make sure you underline or put in bold the main points. However, there were some subjects, particularly about the military, Fuentes said, that would engage Kelly's full attention and he might want to have a long conversation. Normally, Fuentes said, you'll have 30 seconds to talk to him. If you haven't grabbed his attention, he won't focus. Kelly held regular senior staff meetings of the 20 top people from the White House every Monday, Wednesday, and Friday in the Roosevelt Room. He frequently reviewed his conversations with the president. I talked with the president over the weekend, Kelly recounted at one meeting. He's really hot on us getting out of the North Korean peninsula altogether, forcing the South Koreans to pay for THAAD. I've just been going back and forth with him, and I've really laid into him and told him he couldn't do this. As Kelly himself got caught in the Washington political crossfire and was criticized in the media, he spoke more and more about the press and his own role at the senior staff meetings. I'm the only thing protecting the president from the press, Kelly said at one meeting. The press is out to get him. They want to destroy him. And I'm determined to stand in the way, taking the bullets and taking the arrows. Everyone's out to get us. The press hates him. They hate us. They're never going to give us a break on anything. It's active hostilities. And so that's why we're taking all this incoming. They're also turning on me because I'm the one guy standing in front of the president trying to protect him. In a small group meeting in his office one day, Kelly said of the president, he's an idiot. It's pointless to try to convince him of anything. He's gone off the rails. We're in crazy town. I don't even know why any of us are here. This is the worst job I've ever had. Kelly began to have less control, less involvement. Trump called members of Congress when Kelly wasn't around. He called Chuck Schumer, Tom Cotton, Lindsey Graham, Dick Durbin, or cabinet members, underscoring that he was his own chief of staff and his own legislative affairs director. Madeline, he would call out, get Speaker Ryan on the phone. Trump's questions started. How's Kelly doing? He asked Porter. He's tough, but it kind of seems like he's too tough. I don't know that the staff really likes him that much. I think he's helped, Porter answered. Better to be feared than loved. But he's got his limitations. I think he just needs to recognize them. And you do too. Porter said he thought Kelly's weakness was on legislative matters. You really need a good political affairs director because that's not Kelly's background. And if you want your chief of staff to be your chief political advisor, it shouldn't be Kelly. Tillerson complained to Kelly many times about Porter getting Trump to sign decision memos without a sign-off from the Secretary of State. I know you've been trying to loop Rex in, Kelly told Porter. But now you cannot take a decision memo to the president, you can't brief the president on something like that unless you have explicit sign-off. Kelly made clear that feedback from State in general or from Tillerson's chief of staff would not be sufficient. No decisions, Kelly instructed, until you've talked or emailed with Rex specifically. Trump heard about the conflicts. He liked aggressive disagreements. They smoked out a wide variety of opinions. Harmony could lead to groupthink. He embraced the chaos and churn beneath him. At about 9 p.m. Monday, November 27th, more than 4 months after Priebus left the White House, the president reached him on his cell phone. They talked for 10 minutes. "What about the upcoming Senate race in Alabama?" Trump asked. "How was the ocean cruise that Priebus had just been on?" Trump said it was amazing how much they got done together in the first 6 months. "What about tax reform? And the Republican senators who were holding out on tax reform?" Trump said that the stories the New York Times had that week were nuts. "How do you think Rex is doing?" Trump asked. "You think he gets it?" Priebus was careful. He thought Tillerson should have been great, but he was hard with the president, and the president didn't like hard. But the call was not heavy, as if Trump wanted someone to shoot the shit with. Kelly was all business. Kelly would not sit and BS. The president invited Priebus to lunch at the White House for Tuesday, December 19th. Now, as a private attorney, his proximity to the president and his well-publicized meetings were useful with his private clients. The world knew Priebus was still a player for sure. However, the president's questions about Tillerson reminded Priebus of all the times he learned that Trump had sounded out others about him. "How do you think Reince is doing?" It was a bad memory. Trump was always asking everyone their opinions of everyone else, seeking a report card. It was corrosive and could become self-fulfilling, undermining and eating at the reputations and status of anyone and everyone. "The president's MO is to put people back on their heels," Priebus said. "Put all the chips on the table, and then slowly but surely pick off each chip individually. It could be a person, a policy, a country, a foreign leader, a Republican, a Democrat, a controversy, an investigation." Trump would try to leverage anyone by any means, and at times he would succeed. "He uses leverage in a way I've never seen before." Chapter 35. Now that he had agreed to stay to do tax reform, Gary Cohn had to deliver. The current U.S. corporate tax rate was 35%, one of the highest in the world. Reducing it had been a rallying point for Republicans and business people for years. It was all Trump had wanted to talk about at first. During the Bush and Obama years, dozens of large companies had moved their headquarters overseas to take advantage of lower foreign tax rates. This process was known as inversion, because it typically entailed creating a new parent company in a low-tax country like Ireland and making the existing American company its subsidiary. This was a big issue with Trump's business friends. Lowering the corporate tax rate could bring trillions of dollars back to the United States. "The corporate rate's got to be 15%, Trump said. "Sir," Cohn said, "we'll try and get that." Treasury Department calculations showed very few corporations paid the full 35% because of various loopholes and special tax breaks that Congress had passed. Cohn agreed that the U.S. was out of sync with the rest of the world. Some countries like Ireland had a corporate tax rate as low as 9%. "So bring the money back home," Cohn agreed. "Trillions of dollars are parked offshore to avoid U.S. higher tax rates." "About $4 trillion, Trump said. "Even more, possibly $5 trillion. Cohn had a chart that showed it was $2.6 trillion. At one point, the president proposed raising the top income tax rates, currently 39.6% at the highest bracket, for earners in exchange for drastically lowering the corporate rate. "I'll take the personal top rate to 44% if I can get the corporate rate to 15%. Trump said. Cohn knew that was crazy, though he realized Trump, with all his real estate and other deductions, had probably never or rarely paid the full 39.6%. "Sir," Cohn continued,